From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Grand Rapids-based website called Conservative Intel.
So this site purports to be an insider source for news and information about conservative Republicans.
The site is tied to GOP consultant John Yob. And as for the news?
There seems to be a pretty clear pattern here that stories praising Republicans on the site are Republicans that John Yob is working with.
A new U of M class on fake news offers timely lessons.
Where we talk about how when we engage with an issue, we come from the point of clarification, perhaps, instead of confrontation.
And calling out the Census Bureau for not offering an Arab option on the form.
If you check other and you write in an Arab country, they classify you as white. So even if we try to voice our identity on the census form, we end up getting classified as white.
Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, unearthing priceless Roman artifacts in England.
My mind just went racing. Was it, you know, a salve for medicinal purposes or perhaps makeup or foodstuffs? Or it could have been all of these different things that, like, just kind of took me back in time a little bit to try and figure out what would this person have used this for.
We'll hear about a summer study abroad trip destined for the history books. But first, a conservative news website is busily pumping out stories on political candidates, stories that are quickly being shared on social media. But a closer look at this website, Conservative Intel of Grand Rapids, reveals it is not a news operation. Rather, it's linked to political consultant John Yob. His company's made many millions of dollars during the 2016 political campaigns. It's all spelled out in a story by Detroit News Lansing Bureau reporter Jonathan Osting, who's with us now. Hey, Jonathan, it's so good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me again.
And Jonathan is joined by Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Good to always say hi to Rick.
Hi, Cindy.
Before we get into conservative intel and what's on this news site, Rick, give us a reminder just who is John Yob?
John Yob is, in Republican and political consulting circles, a very well-known entity. He is consulting right now with Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly on his ballot drive to make Michigan a part-time legislature. But that's just one of his clients. He's known for technological innovation and practices that at least some people in the Republican Party find exasperating.
Jonathan, tell us about this conservative news website, Conservative Intel.
Sure. Well, Conservative Intel is actually a national news website, but it does have a pretty strong focus on Michigan. And it just so happens that focus on Michigan is on clients that John Yob is working as a consultant for. So Rick mentioned Brian Kelly, also U.S. Senate candidate Lena Epstein, and Secretary of State hopeful Stan Grott. This site has consistently published stories praising these three candidates and criticizing their Republican counterparts potentially in 2018 primaries, including Attorney General Bill Schuette, who could run against Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly in 2018 for governor. So this site purports to be an insider source for news and information about conservative Republicans. But as I, you know, showed in my reporting, it's picking and choosing conservative Republicans who just so happen to pay John Yob through other other businesses that he runs.
And we should point out that John Yob's reach as a political consultant is national. He consults for Republicans in many states as well as presidential candidates, and the conservative Intel site has links to news specifically on Michigan, but also five other states, including, I'm sure that this is a coincidence, early Republican primary and caucus states like Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina.
Yeah, absolutely. And John Yob has also worked with a number of national candidates, both at the congressional level and even worked for, sold lists, anyways, email lists for a number of presidential campaigns. Some of those congressional candidates he's worked for nationwide have also received favorable treatment on conservative intel. So there seems to be a pretty clear pattern here that stories praising Republicans on this site are Republicans that John Yob is working with.
And Rick, are we seeing something new here? I mean, don't liberal or left-leaning political candidates use paid and friendly bloggers and social media types to get their message out as well? Is this any different?
The idea of websites and social media being used in campaigns is certainly not new. And I actually just spent a lot of the weekend and early this week talking with political consultants that I know who were saying that, this is something of a new wrinkle. And it's something that the political consulting industry is probably going to be getting into more of. I mean, maybe as part of the menu of services that a political consulting firm will offer, you know, right now that'll include, you know, door-to-door strategy, helping to design brochures and creating and placing television and radio ads, fundraising, email lists, things like that, that maybe a placement on a quote news unquote site will also be part of the offerings.
One-stop shopping. Jonathan, does that oft overused and misused term fake news apply here to conservative intel?
Certainly critics I talked to in both Republican and Democratic circles used that description here because it is being spread far and wide as what the website purports to be insider conservative news. There's certainly no indication on the website, if you just went to it, who owns it, what the motivations might be for the news. So certainly seems to fit that description. We've seen a lot of slanted news become more prevalent, but this at least, although it may be the way things are going, seems fairly unique in its direct ties to a single consultant.
And I noted as I went through the site, there isn't a single story with a byline, so you'd have no idea who's writing this.
That is correct.
Jonathan, this conservative intel site is just one piece in John Yab's political empire, as you put it in your story. Give us an idea of some of the other things he's involved in.
Yeah, well, you mentioned one-stop shopping is another description that I've heard used about John Yab. His main business is Strategic National. It's based in Grand Rapids that does general consulting for clients. But he's built a whole suite of products that he can offer them. He has a company that processes credit card transactions for political contributions. He has a company that does direct mail for politicians. He has a company that builds websites or does digital ad management for politicians. And his most lucrative business, at least in the 2016 cycle, was a business called Conservative Connector, which builds email lists of conservatives, of folks who, hey, might not trust the mainstream media that well. And he sells these email lists to, for instance, President Trump. He sold it to Trump's GOP rivals like Jeb Bush, Carly Fiorina, Chris Christie. Everybody wanted this list that John Yab has had because they know it's another way for them to get their message out by going directly to these people.
And we should point that it's hard to overstate the value of lists like these to politicians and political campaigns, that they're useful in get out the vote efforts, that they're very, very useful and primarily used for fundraising. So a good email list can be well worth the investment that you put into paying to buy it.
Rick, it is interesting to note that just last Thursday, John Yab was the subject of some unflattering discussion at a meeting of the Republican National Committee members where the U.S. Virgin Islands rep sent everyone Jonathan Osteen's story and then quoting him here, "We can win elections without the bad actors. Our party should never reward bad actors." So how come the RNC is talking about whether or not it should bar John Yab from getting any more RNC campaign contracts?
Well, we know that one person at the RNC is talking about barring John Yab from getting contracts. We don't know, you know, how far that discussion is going. And don't forget, John Yab divides his time between Michigan and the U.S. Virgin Islands, where he's sort of waged war on the local political establishment. And so there are some, you know, hard feelings there as well.
Sure. The person raising this issue with the RNC who shared my link was, in fact, from the Virgin Islands, so has some bad blood with John Yab in the past. It's not clear whether there are any serious discussions beyond the concerns that this one individual has raised.
Although, you know, the RNC will base its decisions on contracts, on whether or not they think that those contracts will help them win elections.
Yeah, bottom line. Does John Yab's news site, air quotes around news, does it raise any ethical questions? I mean, are there any ethics or rules in political strategy?
Well, I guess it depends on which political strategist you talk to. I mean, John Yab is known for being very effective, and this certainly is probably another example of him building an effective business model, but one that does certainly raise ethical issues. I mean, if people are reading this news, they don't know where it's coming from. They could be, you know, left with the impression that, for instance, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly is the most conservative Republican in Michigan, and Attorney General Bill Schuette is a flaming liberal, which, of course, neither of the men would probably agree with those descriptions. So certainly there's the potential for readers to be tricked into the content and to believing the content that they're reading. And that is an ethical concern.
There are, by the standards of people who practice the profession for, you know, what are considered mainstream news organizations, conservative intel would not be considered an ethical news operation. But you know, that's not that's not the purpose of the website, and it's not trying to win over a mainstream audience.
I'll note too that while we call it a news site, and the site does in fact advertise it as such online, John Yab simply referred to it when in his comments to me as an information distribution channel. That's what he's trying to do here. He's trying to get out information to the public, not necessarily provide news.
And looking ahead, is this a start of a new trend? I know, Rick, you spoke with political strategists on both sides about this. What do they say?
The consultants that I talked to all said that, one, they thought that what John Yab has done is forward-thinking and entrepreneurial, and that this is a space that the political consulting business is going to have to get into. Like I said, figuring out, you know, maybe not necessarily having your own, quote, you know, information dissemination, unquote, website, but certainly access to a sympathetic one so that you can place items on that and then have them distributed and redistributed via social media.
Jonathan?
I'd agree with that. I think, we've seen candidates more and more through social media already having that avenue to shape their own narrative, to tell their own story about the campaign. Certainly the president does this with Twitter on a regular basis. What this allows them to do, though, is share a third-party link that might give validation to the message they're trying to get out, at least in the eyes of readers. So it can be another powerful tool for them, but a confusing one for readers who are simply looking for fair and unbiased information.
Detroit News Lansing Bureau reporter Jonathan Osting, joined by Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Think about it. It wasn't that long ago when most of us had never heard that term, fake news. Now, after the presidential campaign and election, you can barely go a day without hearing that phrase. What is real news and what is fake is a critical issue for our country. And that's why the University of Michigan Library has joined with the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts, and they've created a new class on fake news, a one-credit course called Fake News, Lies, and Propaganda, How to Sort Fact from Fiction. Angie Early is a librarian with the U of M Library, and she will teach the first class this fall. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How'd the class come about?
Well, as you said, with the election and with all of these issues coming out about social media and fake news and people identifying information as being fake or false, it became clear to us, thinking about the mission of the library in terms of thinking about information, not just collecting information, but critically thinking about information, that this was an important need for our students and others on campus.
So what's covered in the course?
So the course has several components. We're going to discuss fact-checking. We're going to look at developing strategies for any news source. We're going to look at not just being well-read, we're going to look at being widely read. So considering other news sources beyond what you normally consume the news in the settings that you do that in. So those are some of the subjects that we'll be covering. We'll be looking at infographics. We'll be looking at social media and media fragmentation. We're going to invite journalists to the class and talk about code of ethics in the news and in the news media and things like that.
And what's the ultimate hope for these students that they're going to walk away from this course? What are they going to walk away with?
They're going to walk away with a personalized strategy for reading any kind of or watching or seeing in their Facebook feed or anything kind of news.
And this is, it strikes me that this is really something that we could all use. I'm just thinking of people in my Facebook world, and I'll see somebody share something, not even necessarily political, but go to Snopes and do a quick check, and you find out it's not true, and I will put that on there and say, check this. Right. We're so gullible.
We're going to talk a little bit about what we bring to the news. So, is reality subjective? Things like that. What are the kinds of preconceived notions we may have if we read about news in a specific topic? And how can we get past those preconceived notions?
I think that there are a lot of people that you know, you hear that if just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true, but I don't know that that has necessarily sunk in.
Right. There's a lot of research about what successful consumers of the news do, and we can look at the strategies that they use.
Such as,
they have a news article open. They almost always have an empty tab in their browser open as well. And the minute they come across something that they've never seen before, they use their search engine to find information about it. They might even just search the general topic and see what other people are saying about it. So they are active, engaged with the news while they're reading it.
I think we've all watched this, particularly in these past 9 months, when you see the visceral reaction of someone in power or someone of a particular political perspective. News they don't like, slam the door. That's fake news. How dangerous do you think, as you've been considering all of this and developing this course, how dangerous is this to our country?
Well, we would hope that for us to be good citizens, we would be informed citizens. And that is one of the sort of guiding principles for any library interaction when it comes to information, that we think about how what we do when we figure out we need more information, where do we go to find that information? Because that informs our actions. It informs how we vote. It informs how we engage with our community. And so we hope to even model that kind of behavior within the classroom setting, thinking about how we would manage the classroom in order to develop community.
And it certainly strikes me that a library, any library, is a very good place to focus these kinds of efforts, or to actually begin to be the genesis of these efforts.
Exactly. People might think of libraries as places where there are collections of information, like books, right? But libraries have been engaged in this conversation about information since the beginning of libraries, right? Thinking about, a person might say, I need more information. Well, how do they even know they need more information? And then they have to come either virtually to the library, to a library website or a library database or an ebook or something like that, or come physically to the library and start asking questions, because sometimes we don't know what we don't know. And so we have to have a conversation about that. And then we have to stop and think, how can I evaluate the information that I'm reading, right? What are its strengths? What are its pros and cons? You know, what is missing here? How do you know what's missing, right? You talk with someone. And the librarian can be the person where it is an engaging conversation around thinking about information, evaluating it, and then thinking about how to use it to make decisions about our community.
How are you going to have the students in this course in fake news, lies, and propaganda sorting fact from fiction? What kind of exercises are you thinking of having them doing?
So, for example, there is a website put together by the Wall Street Journal, and it's called Red Feed, Blue Feed. It has various social issues and topics. I don't know if you've seen this, Cindy, where you can click on it and you can see an example side by side of what a Facebook feed would look like in a traditional liberal and a traditional conservative thing. Facebook feed. And so what you would do is you can look at one of these topics and then have students go to perhaps a library encyclopedia and look up the topic, look up the social issue. There's actually encyclopedias that are just about social issues. People don't even know that those are out there. Or even if you went to Wikipedia and looked at this background, you don't have to use a licensed resource. How does that differ when you look at maybe a traditional, even a traditional media news source? Look at Michigan Public Radio's reporting on this issue and compare it to these two Facebook feeds.
What do you hope that this class takes root and continues through the foreseeable future? What kind of difference do you hope it makes?
I really hope that there can be some peer-to-peer kinds of things happening. So we can model students in the classroom learning from each other, and then they can see that model and take it home, can take it to their friends, can take it to their sorority. They can talk about these issues where we talk about how when we engage with an issue, we come from the point of clarification, perhaps, instead of confrontation.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Angie Early, librarian with the U of M Library, she'll be teaching the first class of a new course, Fake News, Lies, and Propaganda, How to Sort Fact from Fiction. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Every study abroad program offers you a chance at discovery, a different culture, different country, new food, a course that teaches you something new. A group of students from Washtenaw Community College took discovery to a whole new level. They discovered priceless Roman artifacts during an archaeological dig at an ancient Roman fort in England. Dr. Christopher Barrett is the anthropology instructor who brought the students from WCC to the United Kingdom for this study abroad program. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we welcome Kim McGinnis, who is one of the students who was on this dig. Hey, Kim.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So tell us, Christopher, about this Roman fort where you were at.
The Roman fort that we were at is a little south of Hadrian's Wall. Hadrian's Wall was built in 122 AD. It was the northernmost part of the Roman Empire. And this fort was actually built somewhat before that, starting in about 85 AD. And it went through 9 different iterations, the first 5 of which were actually just wood, and then it later became stone. What we were excavating was actually one of the earlier iterations of the fort, something that was before they actually really got underway on Hadrian's Wall and really started really establishing themselves in northern England.
And Hadrian's Wall, wasn't it really meant to keep those pesky Scots out of Britannica?
They weren't really Scots at that
they
point.
They were Picts.
They were Picts, but yes, it was meant to keep the Picts out. Mm-hmm. Really what it was meant to isolate what they had in Great Britain from what was the frontier. And this was the frontier of the Roman Empire, the northern frontier. So that's really what Hadrian's Wall was established at. There was another wall that was actually built slightly to the north of that, and then relatively quickly, it was abandoned a little bit later on, but it was really Hadrian's Wall that established that border.
And the name of the fort is?
Vindolanda.
Vindolanda. And this site has been under excavation for quite a few years, hasn't it?
Yeah. This site was originally purchased. I shouldn't say the entire site was purchased, but a nearby property was purchased by a man named Robin Burley in 1929. It then kind of passed on through his family, and now his grandson, Andrew Burley, is actually the chief of excavations at Vindolanda today.
And it's yielded a lot through the years, has it?
Well, it's the best preserved of the Roman sites that we have because the unusual conditions that they have at the site tend to isolate a lot of those cultural materials in anaerobic strata. So they're sealed between 2 layers of clay, and you don't get the kind of decomposition you find at other archaeological sites. For instance, they found 650 sets of Roman shoes. I don't know of any other place in the world where they've actually found that many shoes. And you'd think that there's not a lot you can learn from shoes, but you can tell whether it was a man or a woman's shoe, whether it was a child's shoe. They're actually getting some idea about the demographics at the site just by looking at the shoes that they pull out of there.
That's stunning. Well, Kim, I have to start right out. What did you guys find this summer?
Well, I would like to say there's kind of 2 general categories, if I may, about finding these artifacts, what we call general finds and small finds. The general finds are going to be things that you kind of anticipate finding at the site. For example, if you're digging in what is known to be a trash heap, you're going to find animal bones, leather scraps, things of that nature. That's not to say it wasn't exciting, though. The first time I pulled a cow's jawbone out of the ground, it was half the jawbone. It was this huge piece. And I'm just like in awe and I'm thinking, this is so incredible. And there was a group of Canadian students that had been digging on the site for a few weeks at that point, and they were just kind of like, oh, yeah, it's a big one, but, like, we found a bunch, you know? So just put it in the bag with the rest. But and it did get a little commonplace after a while, but it was still incredible. And then the small finds are not necessarily small in terms of size. What they indicate is more of a uniqueness, something that's not necessarily expected. Small finds are what's going to end up in a museum. Mm-hmm. And my first thing that I personally found that was a small find was a wooden jar lid, about the size of a silver dollar. The jar itself did not find, but just holding this wooden lid that, to be quite honest, had no cracks in it. It was very obvious where the indentation was, where it would have sat on top of the jar. And there was absolutely nothing I could glean from it to tell what would have been in there, but my mind just went racing. Was it, you know, a salve for medicinal purposes, or perhaps makeup or foodstuffs, or it could have been all of these different things that, like, just kind of took me back in time a little bit to try and figure out what would this person have used this for. A few days later, actually, I believe the next day, I found a copper alloy stud, and that was incredible because it's this tiny little stud that looked almost like a stud earring, but it was still, after being in the ground for almost 1,800 years, super shiny, and it's just on the ground. It was right beneath my feet as I was walking through the dig site. I just happened to look down, and there's this little shiny thing, and I pick it up, and it would have been used to adorn a piece of leather or something like that. And at the Vindolanda Museum, they actually have a few examples of scraps of leather with several studs still on them. So that was incredible to see. And then, of course, we got to the Roman tablets,
Exactly. So the pièce de résistance, the Roman tablets.
Yeah, this is one of the few places that you can find written language this old in the United Kingdom. And this is really the oldest example of written language in the United Kingdom. The oldest example of a woman's handwriting in the United Kingdom as well, which is kind of significant. And these were just things that people had written, and they had been thrown out, just like trash, you know, like our own.
We'd write a shopping list and throw it away.
Yeah. And that's really the amazing part about what we found this summer, is that they usually don't find these. They usually don't find them intact. The last time that they found this many of these tablets intact was 1992. So it had been a long time since they'd had this kind of yield come out of the site. And in the one section we were working, this sort of waterlogged trench that we were working in, we recovered 25 of these tablets.
What are they made of?
They are made of a variety of types of wood. Some of them are made of pine. Some of them are made of oak as well. The really amazing finds, though, are what are called confronting tablets, where you actually have two pieces of wood which are folded in on each other. And that has the greatest chance of preserving the actual handwriting and the actual language, which
stands
are on the tablets.
Reason, yeah.
And as I understand it, they're already actually starting to extract some of the actual language from these tablets in that kind of painstaking process of trying to curate the materials after they get them out of the ground. So it was really exciting, and I didn't find any, but my students did, and they found quite a few, as did some of the Canadian students. It was just amazing.
What's that moment like?
I mean, to start, the moment is to kind of explain how we were digging on the site, you'll be down in the trench. There's 2 to 3 people with shovels and buckets, and the soil is very wet and dense, clay matter and other things. So they're cutting it in chunks and sections, putting it up to us, and there's the majority of people on the surface next to wheelbarrows, and we're very carefully breaking apart everything to search through it. So you are sitting in front of this wheelbarrow covered in muck, and you happen across this little bit of wood, and it may be the wood matting that would have been the flooring of that time, and we went through a lot of that. Or shingle, or just random bits of just odd wood. And so we had our instructors, Andrew Burley, there was also Penny and Beth and Marta, and they were available for us to kind of approach and say, okay, is this wood or is this more important wood? And that was the moment where you really start to get, because then you see them looking at it and it's real small pieces, but they're hemming and hawing and really trying to decide. And it got real interesting when Beth or when Penny had to go talk to Andrew, because Andrew Burley being in charge of the whole thing.
He's Mr. Big.
Yeah,
yes,
they had been working on the site for many a year with him, so they were very well versed in what these tablets look like, but sometimes they just wanted to get that double check. And when you saw Andrew's head start to nod up and down from across the site, that's when your heart really got racing, because you are finding something that could contain who knows what. It could be some personal message. It could just be a list of goods that are requested, or we need more beer or something like that. And it's just, you just get so excited. It's incredible. Just incredible.
Do you find yourself thinking that the last hands that touched this were over 1,800 years ago? It could have been some Roman centurion. It could have been a Roman foot soldier.
Yeah, I mean,
who knows?
You are the first person to touch this artifact or this little bit of leather or this, you know, this stud. You're the first person to touch that in almost 2,000 years. You know, I mean, 2,000 years ago, there was not an England, a Scotland, you know, in Ireland in the modern sense. You know, we're talking about a place that's not anything like it is today, and that just boggles the mind.
But I think what is like today is when you start to get into the post-excavation preservation process of these tablets, where they're able to preserve the writing and then go, you know, with ultraviolet radiation and look at what is actually written on them and start to decipher it. And you start getting messages like, they're still working on the ones that we have found, but ones in the past, you know, they found it was a general's wife inviting another general's wife to her birthday party kind of thing. And it's that kind of connection that just, it seems so far removed in time from you, but the message is so
so familiar to how we live our lives today. And I really think it's important to remember that, because I think a lot of people approach history with this, you know, it just feels so distant and it's so not, you know, related to me. But these are still people that still live their lives and loved and had friendships and wrote to people they cared about, just like we do.
Well, congratulations on making some archaeological history with discovering these tablets at the Roman fort at Vindolanda. Very, very exciting moment. I can only imagine what that was like. Kim McGinnis, one of the students who helped make that discovery, and Dr. Christopher Barrett, anthropology instructor at Washtenaw Community College. Vindolanda, an ancient Roman fort in the north of England. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
WNUC 96.7, Detroit's Community Radio.
Now, don't worry, you didn't tune in the wrong station. This is still Michigan Radio. But today we're going to take a few minutes to tell you about a different radio station, one that focuses on Detroit and its various neighborhoods, one that hopes to be a space for residents to speak out about what matters to them. Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman reports.
Joan Ross is a reverend and community organizer who works in Detroit's North End neighborhood. It's a part of the city that's adjacent to a residential and retail boom. Like a lot of people who've worked or lived in the city for a while, she's thinking about what those changes mean. Ross says a lot of the investment happening seems to benefit new residents rather than the people who've been here for decades. She wanted to create a space for those longtime Detroiters to have conversations about their changing city, and she thought a community radio station would be a good way to do it.
We always envisioned the station to be a unifying place that groups all across the city have this radio station.
And Ross says she wanted the station to serve more people than just those living in the North End neighborhood.
We want this to be all the communities in Detroit. That's why we chose the call letters that we did. Our call letters are WNUC, which stands for North End Uniting Communities.
She got a little seed money from a foundation, but the rest came from neighbors and just everyday people.
So all the rest of the money was earned by grassroots efforts, spaghetti dinners, chicken dinners, just block clubs coming together and helping us with this.
WNUC's mission is to shed light on topics in Detroit that often get ignored by mainstream news outlets, things like the positive work happening in every Detroit neighborhood. One of the shows Ross hosts is called My Block, My Hood, My City. Here she is talking with community activist Ron Turner.
The city has taken on a drastic change from the time Mayor Young left office to where it's standing right now. And, you know, I don't see where the community, the real community is really involved in what's going on in the city of Detroit.
So you're saying it feels like two cities, huh?
Yeah, the tale of, that's absolutely.
Absolutely the tale of two
Ross
cities.
Ross says the goal of the show is to get as many voices on air as possible.
Not necessarily yours may be the best opinion voice, or you might have the right angle voice, but your voice counts too. We want to hear you.
There's also a local news hour, a Spanish news broadcast, and a Motown music show. And on Sunday nights, kids can tune in for bedtime stories.
The story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Goldilocks.
WNUC is a low-power FM station. That means it's non-commercial and mostly educational, according to the FCC. Its signal reaches about 300,000 people in Detroit, covering from downtown to the North End neighborhood and even stretching as far west as southwest Detroit. Nicole Simmons is a fan of the station. She calls it her go-to place to find out about community projects.
I didn't even know there were so many neighborhood groups doing things in the city until I heard about it on here.
Simmons stumbled across the station while driving home from work. Now she's more invested in knowing about the city's neighborhoods.
We need more of these stations. I mean, it's cool to hear about what's happening downtown and all, but there's more to Detroit than that little area.
WNUC launched in May. If you want to hear about different things going on in the city, you can stream it online at WNUC.org. I'm Bryce Huffman.
Dearborn likes to boast it has the highest proportion of Arab Americans in the nation. But according to the U.S. Census, of the city's approximately 100,000 people, about 89% of them are white. How can that be? Because according to the U.S. government, Arab Americans are classified as white.
We deserve our own box. I want to start a rally right here today in Dearborn, Michigan. We're not white. Because, listen, I grew up with white people. We are different. We are different. We are really different. We are so different. For instance, did you know if you go to your white friend's house and his mom asks you if you're hungry, if you say no, she actually doesn't bring you anything to eat. Did you know that? And they start eating around you while you said you weren't hungry.
And that was the voice of Michigan-based comedian and writer Amer Zahr from his recently released documentary, We're Not White. And it's a pleasure to say welcome back to Stateside, Amer.
Thank you.
That is such a great point and funny, and you did hit a button with everybody there. So if there has not been a specific box for Arab Americans to check in the census taken every 10 years in this nation, what have people been choosing all these years?
Well, the way the United States government does this is there's this part of the government called the Office of Management and Budget, and they actually classify what the different races are. And white has been defined for a long time as people who have European and Middle Eastern North African descent. And so there's a long history to that that I go through in the movie and that I actually teach about. But what happens is on the census form, so there's all these boxes on the census form. Everybody has a box, and Arabs don't have a box. If you're an Arab and you know the definition, you might check white. However, even if you check other, and you write in an Arab country as your place of origin, the United States Census Bureau will classify you as white. So, because that's part of their definition. Anyone who checks other gets thrown into some box. That's part of the Census Bureau's job. So, if you check other and you write in an Arab country, they classify you as white. So, even if we try to voice our identity on the census form, we end up getting classified as white. And we don't get classified as a white person who checked other and wrote in Lebanon or Palestine or whatever. You just get classified as white.
And in your film, you do mention some of the older generations of Arab Americans actually advocated to be classified as white.
Well, that's the way this country worked. I mean, when our founding fathers made this country, they had to decide, how do you get membership? How do you become a citizen? How do you become naturalized? And the first naturalization law of 1790 said very explicitly that you had to be white. And that was the law in America all the way until 1952, that you had to be white legally in order to gain naturalization in the United States of America. So this idea of whiteness equaling Americanness is a long, long-standing tradition. It's only been out of our laws for about 60 years. And so when a lot of Arabs started coming about 100, 120 years ago, and not just Arabs, any group, when they tried to gain naturalization or citizenship, they would petition for whiteness. And Asian people, like Japanese guy came in and showed up and he said, hey, I'm white. And the courts very quickly told him, no, you're not what we mean when we say white. A guy who was half European and half indigenous from Canada, like half what they called Indian at that time, showed up and said, hey, I'm white. And the courts told him, well, actually, you're half Indian and you're half white, which means you're not majority white, so you're not white. I mean, all these cases came through. Arabs, because we're sort of just off-white, you know, just like a little off, not totally off, we petitioned for whiteness, and there were conflicting cases in the courts in the teens, and this had to get resolved in the higher courts. And so we eventually got classified as white, and mostly that was a virtue of almost all the immigrants coming at that time were Christian. Almost all the Arab immigrants coming at the time were Christian. And their Christianity served as sort of a proxy into whiteness.
Folded them right into the
group. Yeah, the idea of Americanness, right?
Yes.
And so we got it. Then in the 40s, we ended up with another problem because then some Muslim Arabs showed up and said, hey, you've been saying Arabs are white. We're white. We want to get in. And the courts told them, no, you're not white. You're not what we mean. And so then that had to get resolved. And then, like I said, in the 50s, that regime was taken away. But we've been classified as white ever since then. And it's a real misidentifier. You know, mm-hmm. It's one thing to not be identified. It's worse to be misidentified because we're not white in any way that white means. I mean, we don't get any white privilege, that's for sure. I mean, if I commit a crime, they're not going to say, hey, that white guy committed that crime.
Well, the sentiment toward being classified as white, as you point out very clearly in your film, has definitely evolved through the years. Let's listen to some of the young Arab Americans that you spoke to in your film, We're Not White.
Do you think white people really think you're white?
No. No. Not at all.
If there was a box that said Arab on the census form, would you check it?
Absolutely.
Why don't you feel white?
Because that's not what I am. We're not white.
Do you feel white?
Sometimes. When I'm around black people, I feel white.
All right, when you're around black people, how do you feel when you're around white people?
Black.
That, you know, boy, it's a fascinating thing. You're doing this in humor. But the ramifications of not being counted are really serious. I mean, why does it matter that Arab Americans be counted as their own group in the official U.S. Census?
You know, that's one of my favorite parts of the movie, actually, when I ask her, how do you feel when you're around black people? She says, I feel white. How do you feel when you're around white people? I feel black. You know, sort of this sort of out-of-placedness, you know, all the time. Not being counted means that you are not seen as part of the fabric of America. You know, when your box is not there, you feel like you don't belong. And that is something that has been perpetuated in American society and American media for such a long time. This idea that Arabs and Muslims, because these terms get conflated even though they're not the same, are perpetually foreign, perpetually other. And having a box means that it would be finally accepted that we are part of the American fabric, and we are a group that deserves recognition and protection. Because remember, a box would then give you some sort of legal protection, which we now don't have.
Discrimination, tracking, and political power all tied up with that
box.
Well,
I mean, we end up in crazy situations now. So no one can deny that there's discrimination against Arab Americans in this country. But there have been legal cases that have ended up with ridiculous conclusions. So, for instance, there have been actual cases where a man was discriminated against in his job because he was Arab, like explicitly discriminated against because he was Arab, and he sued. And courts have told him, well, here's the problem. We believe you, but here's the problem. You're white, technically, and the person that you're saying discriminated against you is white, and legally there's no such thing as white-on-white discrimination, so we can't let your case go forward. And this kind of stuff happens all the time. So, if, for instance, in employment discrimination cases, the way the law works is you don't just file a lawsuit. You go to the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and you file a claim with them first to see if you can file a lawsuit. Well, when a bureaucrat is taking in your complaint, Arab is not a box for them to check off of. So we're not part of the bureaucracy. We're not part of the process. And so we have to do extra things. Basically, everybody has everybody's playing football and they all have helmets and we don't. We don't have the same tools in our toolbox as every other minority has.
You've been working on this documentary, We're Not White, for at least 4 years. Why has this been such an important project to you?
Well, it's taken 4 years because I've been lazy. That's number one.
But we'll give you that.
Also, busy is another way to put it, but also lazy. But also now I think was the right time to make it fully public because the Census Bureau is going to have to make a decision very quickly about what they're going to do. There's been talk about there becoming what they call a MENA box, which Middle East North Africa box, on the census form. With the Trump administration now, I'm not so sure that it's going to happen. The Obama administration had expressed some sort of support for it. But with the Trump administration, I'm not so sure that it's going to happen at all. Because remember what a box does. It does three important things that I think maybe a Trump regime might be against. Number one, it normalizes us, right? It makes us normal, part of the American fabric, which I'm not so sure that Trump would want to do. Number two, it gives us that set of rights, that ability to sue for discrimination, gain minority contracts, which we don't currently have. And I'm not so sure he'd be in favor of that. But most importantly, right, let's look at what's been happening in America since Trump got elected, since before he got elected, and especially in the past couple weeks. When I look at Charlottesville and all these other things that are happening, what I see happening is the census. The Census Bureau has said that because of demographic changes in America, that white Americans will be a minority by 2042. So they'll be less than 50% of the population. Don't worry, white people, everything's still going to be fine, but you will be less than 50% of the population. Well, that white count in America currently includes 6, 7, maybe 10 million Arab Americans. What happens if you take them out and you give them their own box? 2042 is not 2042. Maybe it's 2035. Maybe it's 2036. And this tension all of a sudden becomes much more real. Now, of course, you only care that white people are going to become a minority if you're a racist or you have some racist views of the nation. But as we see, that's a bigger group of people than we might be comfortable with. And so and Trump might be one of those people. So the question is, would he support it knowing all those things? I don't think that he would. Is he going to get that educated about the issue? I don't know. But this won't go forward without support from the executive branch. Remember, the Census Bureau and the Office of Management and Budget are all under the control of the president.
So we shall see.
We'll see, we'll see.
You've released this film on YouTube last week. So people can see it for free, go to YouTube and look for We're Not White. What do you plan to do with this film?
I really want to spark the discussion. I've been doing comedy shows and writing a lot. You know, I did a comedy tour in 2010 called We're Not White. I've been doing this stuff for a very, very long time. But I think that the conversation has become much more energized now because like I said, the Census Bureau is going to make a decision soon. Really, that means the president is going to make a decision soon. And they have to start printing forms. I mean, you know, those annoying people start knocking on your door in 2020. They got to print forms. They got to get all their stuff together. And so I think that this is a question that's going to get answered pretty soon. Arab Americans have been fighting for this for years, for decades. They've been asking for this box. They're now closer than ever. Will this new administration decide to do it? I don't know. Some people think they will because they want to get more numbers on where Arab Americans and maybe Muslim Americans are. But I don't think they're lacking. Like, law enforcement has been tracking us for a very long time. I don't think the Census Bureau is not going to help them find out that there's a lot of Arabs in Dearborn. You know, they already know that. But we need the box in order to just be treated like every other American, to get out of this ridiculousness, to get out of a ridiculous idea and a statistic that says Dearborn, Michigan is 89.1% white. It takes about 2 minutes on Warren Avenue to realize that that is not the case. And we need to get out of that. We need to be treated like everybody else. And we need to be seen by others as part of the fabric of what makes America.
Are you planning to take this on the road or have screenings with conversations with the filmmaker?
Yeah, I would love to. I mean, anyone who wants to do that can always get in touch with me on my website, which is just amerzahr.com, A-M-E-R, like America. That's what I tell white people, A-M-E-R, like America, Z-A-H-R.com. You can get in touch with me very easily there, Facebook, wherever. I would love to take the film to campuses, to communities, and just watch it and talk about it so we can talk about these issues. I know we're not white because I watch the news, and that's part of the movie too, right? I know I'm not white because I watch the news. They do not think that we are white on the news, or else they would call us disturbed, deranged, delusional like they call white criminals on the news. They don't call that. They don't call us that. And even if you look at the other day in Charlottesville, they had a hard time and still have a hard time in the upper echelons of government calling this man a terrorist, whereas it only took a description of the assailant in Barcelona to quickly call that terrorism. That's the world that we live in.
Michigan-based comedian and writer Amer Zahr, and as he said, A-M-E-R, like America, his recently released documentary is We're Not White. Amer is also an adjunct professor at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so very much for listening.